This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Billions of dollars in cancer drugs, quite literally down the drain. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I am Molly Wood, sitting in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, March 1st. So glad to be with you. We start today with waste in the healthcare system. And I know what you're thinking. That is not news. We know that about $1 trillion a year is wasted on unnecessary tests and procedures, but at least there's a chance that some of that stuff could save lives. Cancer researchers are reporting this week that $3 billion worth of leftover cancer drugs will be thrown in the trash this year. Marketplace's healthcare reporter Dan Gorenstein got an early look at the paper published in the BMJ today, and he's here now. Hey, Dan.
Hey, Molly.
Okay, Dan. Is this true? These drugs are being put in the trash?
Yeah. So let's take this one drug for melanoma, Keytruda, as an example, okay? So it's packaged right now in 100 milligram vials. The typical patient needs 150 milligrams. So the hospital or the doctor is going to have to order two vials. And the question is, what happens to the remaining 50 milligrams? Put it all together, Molly, and the paper says that the companies who produce the top selling 20 single dose vials of cancer drugs will make an additional $1.8 billion from this kind of waste. This includes firms like Merck, Bristol Myers Squibb, Amgen, Genentech, and others. For what it's worth, Merck, the people who make Keytruda, they're projected to make more than $1 billion over the next 5 years just from what gets thrown away.
Okay, so piling this on with all of the news we've heard about the pharmaceutical industry lately, really in the spotlight, isn't this going to just ramp up pressure on these companies and this industry?
I mean, on a certain level, absolutely. But at the same time, I think it's really important to say it's too easy to just sort of go ahead and be like, oh, this is the problem of big pharma. This is another big pharma issue. But hospitals and the doctors, the oncologists who treat patients are going to get paid about $1 billion in 2016 for this drug waste, too. As Mireille Jacobson, who's an economist at UC Irvine, told me, this is actually a total market failure.
It's not like there are some just born evil, and these are the devils. This is the system we've chosen, and their incentive is to maximize profit. And in this case, maximizing profit means doing some things that are not good.
So obviously, I'm assuming no one's going to be okay with the idea that hospitals and doctors and drug makers are getting paid for drugs that no one uses, but they're getting paid a lot, so what's the solution?
Well, look, at the end of the day, lots of these doctors, these oncologists and cancer centers, these well-meaning people aren't pushing back against the drug manufacturers saying, you need to package this in a way so we can maximize efficiency for our own customers, the patients. At the same time, the authors of this report say another solution is to require the manufacturers to be more flexible in the packaging size so it's easier to kind of line up exactly what you need and waste less. But a couple of folks I talked to this morning have said to me, look, if you do that and then all of a sudden the drug companies can't make as much money as they had been off of the packaging size, then they're just going to raise the prices. And so one way or the other, we're going to probably end up spending the same amount of money. But one of the questions is how much of that money is going to be spent just on stuff that's being thrown away.
That's Marketplace's health correspondent, Dan Gorenstein. Thanks a lot, Dan.
Thank you, Molly.
Dan was also on the Marketplace Morning Report talking about this story, and you can find more of his reporting at marketplace.org. On Wall Street today, look, a rally. Stocks hit a 7-week high. We will have all the details when we do the numbers. Also today, yeah, it's Super Tuesday. The candidates in today's slate of primary elections are looking for victories, yes, but they need something else that's almost as important, delegates. Those are the people who attend the party conventions and actually do the nominating for the Democrats and Republicans. Now, on the Democratic side, there are these things called superdelegates. These are politicians who aren't pledged to anyone, and they pick their candidates at their nominating conventions. And they can sometimes swing things in a close race. And tell me you're not surprised by this. They can also get campaign contributions from the presidential candidates. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes it from here.
Superdelegates are usually members of Congress, governors, or officials of the Democratic National Committee. And campaign contributions from the candidates are pretty common.
I think we need to be profoundly worried about money in politics in America.
Christopher Robertson is a professor of law at the University of Arizona. He studies campaign finance, specifically how contributions affect behavior. He's found that if people are given money, they feel like they need to reciprocate. He says that could be a factor in a close contest at the party convention.
And if the final tally is a close one, you can imagine a few votes on the margin shifting because of these feelings of reciprocity that are created by money.
There were lots of campaign contributions to Democratic superdelegates during the 2008 presidential campaign, both from Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. The Center for Responsive Politics, a campaign finance watchdog, studied those contributions. Sheila Krumholtz is executive director.
In our research from 2008, campaign contributions for Obama and Clinton predicted endorsements for them 80% of the time.
In other words, the presidential candidate who gave money to a superdelegate usually got that delegate's vote. Krumholtz says there's a strong correlation, but not a clear-cut quid pro quo. That's a point David Hopkins emphasizes, too. He teaches political science at Boston College. He says the superdelegates weigh a lot of factors when deciding who gets their vote at the convention.
Who do the voters in my district support? Who do I think would be a better president? Who do I agree with more on the issues? Who do I think would be a stronger candidate for the party in the general election?
Hopkins says superdelegates aren't as big a part of the mix in the free-for-all race for the Republican nomination. Some Republican National Committee members have something like a superdelegate role, but it's a much smaller group of people. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
We'll have more election coverage looking at the economy in all 11 Super Tuesday states at Marketplace.org. Yahoo filed some financial documents recently, and if you were to translate them into a language spoken by humans, they might read like something like this. Oops. Yahoo bought blogging site Tumblr 2 years ago for $1.1 billion, and now in a fit of buyer's remorse, Yahoo is saying that it overpaid by a lot. The company has reduced the value of Tumblr by $230 million and says it might cut $750 million more. Specifically, Yahoo is writing down something called goodwill. We asked Marketplace's Sabri Benishore to explain what that is exactly.
When you buy a company, you're buying all the stuff in the company, obviously.
The physical assets, trucks, buildings, property, these kinds of things.
Paul Kudrowski is a partner with SK Ventures. It's a venture capital firm. And all that stuff is written down on a company's balance sheet. There are receipts. It's all very neat and tidy. But if you add all those things up, that's usually just a portion of the actual price you pay.
Typically, companies don't get sold for the book value of the company.
Because there are other things that a company has, things that are worth money, things that make money that you can't really nail down, but you still have to pay for them.
Things that don't show up on a balance sheet. So the most obvious example of that is the brand.
It's fuzzy, but it's worth something. Think about Coca-Cola's brand name. But there are even fuzzier things you have to pay for. Alon Kalai teaches at Columbia Business School.
There's leftover, and the leftover is the goodwill.
Goodwill is the fuzziest of the fuzzy values of a company.
Goodwill is oftentimes referred to as the hope value.
Mark Mahaney is internet analyst at RBC.
As in, we hope this asset that we just acquired for over $1 billion will generate X amount of revenue and profits long term, but we don't know.
Yahoo had a lot of hope for Tumblr. Out of the roughly $1 billion Yahoo paid for Tumblr, $750 million was goodwill. In writing that down, Yahoo would be saying, in the words of Paul Kudrowski,
"We screwed up. This isn't worth anything. Our bad. We're writing it down."
In other words, Yahoo's hopes were dashed. In New York, I'm Sari Benashour for Marketplace.
And in further proof that the world is turning either upside down or inside out, or maybe both, the Japanese government just for the first time auctioned off a crop of new 10-year bonds with a negative yield. Translation, investors are essentially paying the government for the privilege of loaning it money. And this just feels kind of wrong. Even weirder, there was strong demand for these things. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson tries to help us understand.
It's actually not that unusual these days for bonds to have negative yields. The Bank of Japan, the European Central Bank, among others, have set negative interest rates, essentially charging to hold money in their accounts instead of paying out interest. Some government bond yields have followed suit.
Negative is the new positive in interest rates for countries that want to stimulate their economy and debase their currency.
But these bonds are still weird, says Marilyn Cohen, CEO of Envision Capital Management.
So it feels like we are on some kind of hallucinogenic drugs here in bondland.
Generally, investors like government bonds because they're safe investments. That appeal might still hold even with negative yields, says Guy Leba, fixed income strategist at Janney Montgomery Scott.
There's a shortage of low-risk assets in the world, so there tends to be a grab for almost any type of government bond at auction right now.
If investors bought, say, U.S. bonds instead, they'd have to worry about exchange rates. And Japan is especially risk-averse, says Takeo Hoshi. He's a professor at Stanford.
Many companies seem to prefer not to invest and hold the cash, or in this case, hold the government bonds, even with a negative interest rate.
Plus, bonds are an investment that people buy and sell. They can go up and down in value. Takatoshi Ito, a professor at Columbia, says investors might be thinking,
buy this asset because you can sell it later with higher prices. It doesn't matter what the intrinsic value is. Just look at the momentum. It's going up. So buy now.
Makes sense. Still feels weird. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the robots of the cartoons and movies of the 1970s are going to be the reality of the 2020s.
Finally, my own personal C-3PO. But first, let's do the numbers. What a lovely day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 348 points, 2 1/10%, to close at 16,865. The NASDAQ increased 131 points, 2 1/8%, to finish at 4,689. And the S&P 500 added 46 points, 2 1/3%, to end at 1,978. Hertz reported fourth quarter earnings. They beat expectations, and stock in the rental giant rose more than 12%. In retail, Kate Spade sashayed up 11%. Coach stitched up a 1% gain. Ditto for Michael Kors. Tech stocks rose across the board with Apple out in front. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year Treasury note rose 1.82%. And you are listening to Marketplace. You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. The largest private real estate development in American history is happening right now in New York. The $25 billion project is called Hudson Yards. When it's done, it will include more than 17 million square feet of office, retail, and residential space. That's more than the entire downtowns of most American cities. But Hudson Yards is much more than just a massive real estate project. These towers are also an enormous bet that the way we live and work is about to change forever. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
Just about every audio story you've ever heard about a big development starts on the ground, with lots of loud construction tools making loud construction sounds. But this is something different. It's less about the buildings and more about what it's going to be like for the people who work in them. So we're starting in a different place. We get there by taking a construction elevator up the side of one of the office buildings under construction. Hope you're not afraid of heights.
So we're standing in the middle of a floor, and there's not a column you see. There's a column at the exterior.
We're getting a tour of the 51st floor of 10 Hudson Yards from Michael Samuelian, a VP at Related Companies, which is developing Hudson Yards. It's unfinished right now, but you can tell from the floor-to-ceiling windows and layout that it's designed for the kind of open office that tech companies love and many other industries are adopting. Related CEO Jeff Blau said the early sales pitches to companies focused on the physical attributes of the buildings. Technology, green construction credentials, that kind of stuff. But that message only went so far.
When we ultimately got to the CEO's office, you can see their eyes start glazing over when you start talking about all those things. And what they really wanted to talk about is their biggest problem, which is how do they attract and retain talent?
And what more and more CEOs believe is that workers want a flexible environment, one where they can work how they want with the option to sit at a desk or open their laptops in a park or cafe down below. Also shops and cultural venues where they can take a break.
So we transitioned our whole story about Hudson Yards to really reflect the environment that we're creating between the retail and the restaurants and the work environment and the residential community. And that's really the pitch that's ultimately attracted people to Hudson Yards.
That pitch has convinced a murderer's row of big companies, including Time Warner, Wells Fargo, and Coach. Hudson Yards is a giant wager that the startup-style open office in a live-work atmosphere is the wave of the future for companies of all kinds. Corporate leaders stress how they're giving modern workers a better environment. But of course, companies benefit too. Lindsay Gallen is a real estate professor at Columbia Business School.
It's a more intensive use of space on a per-person basis.
That's the side of this reimagined work environment companies talk about less. By packing more people per floor, they save money. Hudson Yards has increased elevator and bathroom capacities to handle the density. And the lavish parks, shops, and cultural attractions on the ground sound great. But a key reason corporate tenants like them is because they help keep employees around to work longer, boosting profits. The new workplace has two faces, depending on whom you ask. An open floor plan can catalyze collaboration or murder concentration. And a live-work-play neighborhood can provide welcome flexibility or make it impossible to balance. This wholesale rethinking of the workplace could take us in many different directions. Hudson Yards will accelerate how fast we get there. Back on the ground of the construction site, it's easy to forget that this massive experiment almost didn't happen. Big New York real estate developments tend to be long on drama, but the Hudson Yards skyscrapers didn't have the usual controversy over displacement. They're being built atop train tracks, not homes. But there was some pretty fiery controversy about the site a few years back. There's little sign of that now. You have to stand in a certain spot and know what you don't see. I visited with some related company's execs.
Standing here on 11th Avenue looking westward, we would be looking at a stadium.
Had New York gotten the 2012 Olympics, a combination NFL, Olympic Stadium, Convention Center would have been the crown jewel.
This story now goes back almost 20 years.
Dan Doktoroff was a deputy mayor in the Bloomberg administration and a fierce advocate for New York getting the games. The stadium became highly controversial and was defeated, sinking the Olympic bid. Seeing the 2012 opening ceremony happen in London was a reminder of a stinging loss for an idea he was personally and professionally passionate about.
I think it could have been great, but it isn't, so we move on.
And the city did. Even critics of the Olympic bid credit the momentum it created with making possible the subway extension and rezoning needed to make Hudson Yards happen. Doktoroff says he's thrilled about what the development will do for the city. It's not just talk. He's now CEO of Sidewalk Labs, a Google company focused on urban living. This summer, it'll move, becoming one of Hudson Yards' first tenants.
We're all about applying technology to the city and really helping to usher in that technology-driven future for cities. Well, there was no better place than Hudson Yards.
Along with developers, investors, and the city government, he's betting this site will represent the future workplace. Billions in public and private money are at stake. With the unfinished buildings steadily signing up companies to occupy them, early signs are good for Hudson Yards. But it'll be some time before the project can claim lasting success. It won't be totally finished until the middle of next decade. The way we work and live is changing dramatically. Hudson Yards may be the world's biggest and priciest attempt to find out how. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Many people will tell you they know what the future is going to bring. There are very few who can confidently say that. Alec Ross might be one of them. He was the senior advisor for innovation at the U.S. State Department under Hillary Clinton. Before that, he worked at nonprofits that spread innovation more broadly throughout the world. And he has a new book out that looks at major trends that he believes will emerge within the next 10 years to profoundly change the way we live. The book is called Industries of the Future. Alec Ross joins me now. Hi, Alec.
Hello.
So I guess let's start at the top. There's a lot in here, but what I really want to know is, why did you write this book?
When I was in college, I needed a job that actually paid money. And in West Virginia, that meant working on a beer truck and working as a midnight janitor. And what I saw working shoulder to shoulder with these men on the midnight shift, mopping up puke after country music concerts, was that they would have once had good union wage jobs in a factory, in a mill, or in a mine, but they'd been displaced by automation and by the last stage of globalization. The next 20 years are going to see a pace of change that only moves faster. And so I care deeply about people in working class communities in middle class America trying to figure out how they can navigate through a time of quick change.
Let's talk about some of this newer technology. You described the codification, not codification, of money and markets and trust. What do you mean when you say that?
Artificial intelligence and robotics are displacing labor that is no longer merely manual and routine. It's increasingly replacing work that is cognitive and non-routine. And so I do think that we're getting to the point now where technology is enabling high-value transactions that previously we thought of as having to require a human, somebody in a coat and tie telling us that something is official.
Hmm. I don't think anybody would be surprised if you said that big data would have a big role in shaping the future. But talk a little bit about what exactly that role might look like.
He or she who own the data, control the data, or can interpret the data are the folks who are going to have the economic power in the industries of the future. The robots of the cartoons and movies of the 1970s are going to be the reality of the 2020s. And that's in large measure because of cloud robotics. Instead of C-3PO, who would have very powerful hardware and software whirring in that gold-gleaming body of his, the C-3PO of the 2020s will be a networked device who's able to ping a near-infinite store of data in the cloud to be able to inform what he's doing in our world.
So who are some of the winners and losers here? How do you predict the impact of some of these innovations?
You know, I think that it's impossible to predict the future with any sort of omniscience. So I don't know necessarily which parts of the world will rise and which will fall in the next stage of globalization, but I do have a pretty good sense of what attributes they'll have to have in order to succeed.
And can you talk about those? You talk about that a little bit in your sort of geography of markets.
I believe that the economic systems that are most open, that are most accepting of immigration, that are most accepting of minorities of any kind, and do the most to intentionally create space for women in the workplace will be those that compete and succeed in the industries of the future.
Well, so then last question, hardest one, what does the world look like in 10 years?
I think we are going to live longer, healthier lives of greater abundance, but it's not going to be a better life for everybody. If you look at the 196 country chessboard with more than 7 billion people in it, the next 10 years are going to be really good for a vast majority of those people. But for working class, middle class people in high cost labor markets like the United States and Europe, it's going to be a very difficult time to navigate. And so they're going to have to focus on making sure that they and their kids are adaptable to times of disruptive change.
Alec Ross is the author of Industries of the Future. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Molly.
And speaking of the future, imagine if our next president were to appoint a secretary of the future. Our colleagues on the Marketplace Morning Report are exploring this idea of a cabinet member who would focus on long-term opportunities and threats, all the stuff that doesn't fit into a single election cycle or a federal budget. So what would be job one? America's pension system? Maybe the debt? Check it out and weigh in at Marketplace.org or on Twitter with the hashtag SecretaryFuture.
Ooh.
of those robots we talked about a minute ago. We claim that we are afraid of robots eventually taking over, but it turns out we're also really willing to take orders from them. Way too willing. Researchers at Georgia Tech conducted some experiments recently where they created a simulation of a fire in a building. There was smoke and clanging alarms, and they told people to follow something they called a guidance robot. Now, in early experiments, participants watched the robot break down. It led them to the wrong room. It drove around in circles. But even after they saw that happen, they still followed the robot. The next time researchers ran the experiment, they went into the wrong room behind the robot and they ignored things like emergency exit signs. Apparently, when the time comes, the robots won't even need force to bend us to their will. They'll just need official-looking signage. We're doomed. And that's it. We got to go. Today, the Dow gained 348 points, 2.1%. The NASDAQ increased 131 points, 2.8%. And the S&P 500 added 46 points. That's 2.3%. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our Wealth and Poverty Desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be right back here again tomorrow. See you then. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.